Hello. All right, I'm just going to dive into it. Poetry of Witness, despite its old age as a tradition in poetics, is a recent and often troublesome phrase. Troublesome in the sense of the intrinsic problematic of what it means to be a witness, which often is to be a bystander, a person present but removed from involvement in the act they later relay. The question for the speakers of Poetry of Witness is always whether they did enough, whether, that is, the act of witnessing will be sufficient in and of itself. It's a genre of poetry that forces its speakers to collapse the mythical bifurcation between the personal and the political. And though this helps to resolve one case of myopia, it still leaves these poem speakers with the potential for another. The myopia that neglects that thin zone between the attendance and the attendance that makes witnessing possible and complicity. As opposed to the personal or the political, this witnessing complicity is the social, and we are guilty of it every day. Our media are alive with its failures. David Thacker's poems are poems of witness, and they are alive with the questions of what it means to record failures, to preserve them, to write failures down without the myopic false dichotomy between seeing and complying. His poems examine how seeing, if only seeing, is complicity, and that the action of witnessing does not establish innocence, much less grounds for self-congratulations. Witnessing is, in David's poetry, not the gratified penitence of confession. It isn't the flashy self-lacerations of the martyr on his soapbox. And maybe most importantly, it isn't a distancing effort. His poems aren't a way of simultaneously assigning blame to others and freeing his speakers of their complicit guilt. Instead, they do what many of the original and most powerful poems of witness, many of which involve details of foreign wars, intend to. They report a particular grief they've seen, a suffering they never expected to see. And they admit that this expectation is a symptom of their own negligence. In David's hands, this makes them also poems of entreaty, and sometimes poems of prayer. They seek to help, and they are also asking for help. Help, in a country like ours, where the central concern seems always to be a hermetic and self-seeking kind of power, can sometimes, when used on us or when used by us, feel like the dirtiest four-letter word. But in poems of witness, help is meaning, purpose, and structure. It is, against power, sometimes all we have. In the same way that poems of witness sometimes exist as the only artifact of the suffering they've recorded. And when we are asked for help, when we are asked to give it, especially as readers, it forces us, in turn, to confront, or maybe to confront again, or maybe even to collapse, two other false bifurcations, one between what is individual and what is collective. Another, when acknowledging that something is necessary, between what is easy and what is very, very difficult to do. David Thacker grew up in northern Utah and has taught writing and literature at the University of Idaho and the Port Townsend Writers Conference. A recipient of the Frederick Manford Award from the Western Literature Association, a Pushcart nominee, and a finalist for the Berkshire Prize and the Levis Prize, his poems have appeared in Best New Poets 2015, Plowshares, Plume, Subtropics, The Colorado Review, and elsewhere. He's a fourth-year PhD candidate in poetry. Please help me welcome David to the stage.
That was the nicest introduction. Jamie, thank you. And thank you to Tom and Josh for hosting, and for you who stuck around. I really do. I appreciate the privileges to read for you, and we'll try to make it worth your while. I'm going to start with a poem. It's a long poem. It takes about 12 to 13 minutes to read. Stick with me. It'll be worth it. but I have to start with apologies because it has some Spanish in it, and I don't speak Spanish, but I've been practicing. I even sought out some coaching and practiced some more, and so I'm going to do my best. So you know, La Migra is colloquial for immigration police or ICE. And then there's a longer passage of Spanish, and I'll give you the English translation for those like me who don't speak Spanish. Which is, the translation is, I could let despair slowly rot my life and the lives of my children, or leave. A couple of other things you need to know. Mandorla is an almond-shaped halo. Scapulae is the plural of scapula, like the shoulder blade, right? What else? A fistulated cow is a cow that has a hole in its side so that you can, like, study it and see what it's digesting. It's really weird to see. And where I grew up in northern Utah, quaking aspen are colloquially called quakies. And quakies grow, as they grow, the lower branches drop off as they become like dead weight. And they leave behind what looks like an eye. So they're called eyes. Finally, a probie is a firefighter in a probationary period. I think that's what you need to know. The title of the poem is called In the Story of When the Undocumenteds in the Upstairs Apartment Called 911, I Can Talk. And that opening, that title runs into the opening line, so I'll read it again. In the story of when the undocumenteds in the upstairs apartment called 911, I can talk about the stairs tread. Like rows of open mouths, fanged but harmless if one wore shoes outside, ascending to dinner or descending to dinner. About how in harvest months, those still maws sifted an early hour of lateral sun, and thus spattered the walk up to our mat with white vesica pisces, which means fish bladders, but also means mandorlas around paintings of Christ, a sermon on repeat, and means especially spaces of overlap in Venn diagrams, a list, blank, obscured soon, proposing any two must be somewhere the same. Ice cream and flan, guffaw and howl, family downstairs with three birth certificates and family upstairs with one out of three. I can talk about the wall that fronted both our apartments, the siding's gesture of wood texture. On one panel, a yellow swell where a painter stalled a bit more banana there. 5 inches behind which, according to code, if built to code, laundry hummed in identical halls. And farther, a step. Rooms we paced in nightlight. Paced, bouncing our arms, mumbling. When desperate, whisper-singing lullabies we despised like any abracadabra. And there, see it? In our embouchure's indignation mixed with tenderness, vesica pisces, while each family's infant arched or fluttered lashes, and finally slept. A girl downstairs, a boy up, 2 citizens. Though dreaming, with infinite space shoving upward past his tumble, one might flap and grasp and wake to parents enduring, as is said, La Migra. About the confluence of our furnace pipe and the pipe from our water heater in a closet rarely opened, thin rings at each joint, a single cobweb bulked with dust, the stainless dole and specked, not enough nature to dub them vertical rivers, but each tube supplied walls, like banks, directing a current of warm exhaust from our modest wants at summer's ebb, laundry and a few degrees of heat, up and out, if unimpeded, our vent with its tin man's cap and collar periscoping the roof, and the upstairs vent, a few shingles higher, the same. It's true, the weather could be petulant, and true the words on our mats said welcome. True, the numbers on our doors were gouty old style, with peepholes below the eights. About these things, I can say without worry a great deal. But hear the sirens in the distance. The fire trucks blats through an intersection. Police and ambulance as well. In this story, the neighbors must remain undocumented, as law ensures. And any trail withheld, as deserts withhold the mercies to cross them. One at 19, missionary visa in hand, discovered passing as any resident was safer than where he'd been. The other, well, to say a child, perhaps four, in a big rig trailer, cupping the knobs of her mother's ankle in the purring black, so she can hold among the swelter and sour of each checkpoint in her mind a freckle she knows is under her left palm, and how it bobbed beside her bed, a tiny circle making a circle in the dark, like a sparkler in the dark. To say such a child is illegal, does that make her a melon in a bin of melons, mere contraband? So a citizen might comfortably post of a similar crossing, lock them in and set them on the bombing range, a free target, and a fat message to the fence hoppers. One at four became contraband. The sirens are growing strange, or you are. Hear it? Long seconds and no Doppler break. And the feeling an unfathomable change is coming to where you stand. I left you on a sidewalk outside a yellow apartment with metal stairs, and there's grass, a pinched square of green, more soft, more lank, not yet mown this week, where my wife is sitting with her cheekbones on her knees, dizzy, eyes closed, talking, when she talks, in spurts. And near her, the back of a man pacing, uneasy. Was it a stupid risk? His phone was the phone that summoned so many uniforms. And any might wonder, is he, after all, something other than the concerned neighbor huffing air? I was driving to work, toggling between sports news and news and wind. I did not hear the alarm suddenly shouting from our baby's room with screams from the crib crowding the words. Yawning through town, swigging from Nalgene a few times, a bloodish note in the water from too much iron, not a long commute. Four stoplights, then the parking macadam. Not a long commute at all. I did not see my wife run the hall, slip her hands under fluttering scapulae, and suppress her lift so our daughter's neck could tighten. Infinitesimal blue and fuchsia balloons lazily scattering in pairs on the washes and flows of a house is how I imagine. How else can one see carbon monoxide rising with updrafts and gyres to a nose, a mouth, as fish bladders without fish might drift an ocean into the same fragile caves and amass there. It is a coincidence the harsh and precise voice declared in a British accent. Warning, carbon monoxide detected is one way in English to translate Pudría dejar que la desesperación lentamente pudra mi vida y la de mis niños o partir. Poison prevents my return is another. But what I want is your brain to simulate this crack in faux leather, like a brittle kiss above my wedding band while I turn the steering wheel. I want the hollow door my wife is beating upstairs for help now, the only thing your mind can hold. The latch rattling in its jam, the knocker's flinch. Until the door opens, you won't be shown a face that's contraband on a blur. Her thinking plane in her reach to take our child, who pixelates against her chin. And another blur dials dispatch and hands over his phone. my wife recounts, tamping panic. In the square footage below, carbon monoxide billows toward their feet. I'm near my last light on the far side of our small city, again in awe of fistulated cows, and my wife and he descend the teeth that separate their lives, re-enter to raise windows. In the nursery, she pinches her breath against the sash, lifts through her back, her quads, her shins turn to sand, and her vision smooths. The ambulance, the cruisers, the fire truck haven't arrived as the noisy smears they'll appear to her, like this blur with sleeves and shoes, making her walk a hall, calling this bright path a kitchen. He steers and coaxes, half hoists, half pulls through a gap in panels of white. I want you to hear the ringtone filling up the sedan as I crunch to a stop under Lucky's shade. Ba-da-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. And to see the quakey out front scored with hearts. And midway up the trunk, a deep six tally carved in what would be the white of a large eye that radiates ripples from the cornea like a drop in a sippy cup or terror through a body. I admit I didn't see the tree then, but drove away, leaning into every turn. Months after, running late, that shock when scenery becomes an echo of memory, I swung into the same parking spot and saw the cops retake its place. The tally could mean paychecks or hookups or bouts won by knockout or submission, but an eye is a space that fills with likenesses. As one might see six scars within the eye-like tissue of a tree echoing six neighbors in a reader's eye. What to do with your eyes? Those vesica Pisces in your face. I could have you see how my body accelerated to please, which means it became a prayer. How officers, bored, leaned against the stairs while a masked probie with a sensor, trimmed red and chunky like a toddler phone, nonchalantly swept the interior, then startled shouted, 4400. We could imagine the ending where my wife can't remember her name instead of an ambulance ride, a little oxygen. But let's linger with the neighbors while we can. We've been calm and I forestalled. One's with the chief now. On the lawn, one sits with my wife, our kids tumbling on a blanket. Hear them tell me to call from the ER. Watch this woman who cradled my child for the EMT and now is stretching her child's arm until he grins and waves, see you soon. And this man who might not be here long. Time to call your representatives about DACA. Okay, I'm going to read just one more poem. Apparently, the longer that I'm in Tallahassee, the longer the poems get. So I've been working on a poem all summer that I'm calling a verse essay, and I'm going to try out just the first, what I think of as the first movement on you. So it's the first six sections. And I need to explain the title because it won't make sense because we won't get to the part of the poem that deals with the title. The title is Mormon Beef, a Case Study. And it's a Mormon Beef is a reference from my family history when some of my ancestors were in prison and some the jailers tried to feed them human flesh, to paint them black. So that's what that refers to. Mormon Beef, a case study. One, Here is another story about the black body. In one episode, Eunice McCrae, my four-greats grandmother, baptized Mormon 18 months before, carries her infant across Missouri from far west to Liberty to visit the husband squatting in a low-ceilinged basement cell. Taking dictation through the winter will be his crucial action, and Eunice will make herself post office, postmistress, and carrier, tucking letters into her socks, her baby's homespun gown. The guards will search her only once, find nothing. The child, for now, is nameless. She's abandoned, moving their few belongings out of state to see her husband and to get her son a name. No part of her thinks she's black. No part of Alexander would entertain the notion his wife is black. Not the whir between his shoulder blades when his need to stand his full height accumulates. Not the indignation ever ready to rise in her chest like a bear or the wrath of God in a spoiled blueberry patch. 2. I will tell how I enjoy some of the pleasures of whiteness. They are subtle and many. I want to be as precise as I can to know myself. In the theology governing like an old oak, the wilderness at the center of my life, to know oneself and one's species is what any child of God needs above all else, except to know God. And these knowings are not separable. What is the wilderness? A confluence of genetic lines, a thick undergrowth of stories. 3. The McCrae headstone now is all revision, a slant double of Georgia gray granite with roses etched by machine above their names, as if they died within the decade and not outside a century ago. You can see in the background of one photo the Salt Lake City cemeteries full of such stones, uniform and glossy in the mown grass, not a tilt or strewn bouquet among slabs that seem one more case of reaching for that respectability that claims to be an exceptional paragon of the common. I sit at a laptop with a North Florida avian chorus splash painting the morning, browsing photos and clippings, a family tree. I grew up 20 minutes north of Eunice and Alexander's bones and have never shuffled in the heat above them. The original markers, likely limestone defaced by desert snow, where have they gone? Granite respectability eluded the McCrays all their lives. But chiseled under Alexander in cup and caps, a descendant has paid to remind the morning walkers, grievers, and history buffs he was incarcerated, an expensive word, in Liberty Jail with Joseph Smith, their prophet. Three other men passed the Missouri winter with them under lock, including Hiram, Joseph's brother. A fourth left on bail. It was a time when a town in a slave state could be named Liberty without irony. In Mormon lore, the irony stops with the men in the jail and dubious charges. Below Eunice's name is silence, no caps in her story. Nothing about, for instance, fabrics. On the frontier, all was scrabble and handmade among the poor, and as she walked, it would have been her own skill and time, whatever she could hold back from looters, that kept or didn't keep the child and her body warm. She pulls up over the boy's head before setting out something soft as chaff. Every rough half mile, as any parent traveling slowly in the cold, she peeks through the fold slung at her heart. 4. When I drop my children off at school, and when I watch each teacher's face and track the vocal tones, the book suggestions, homework, and report card comments, the colors and depictions of the many stickers, what names sell what to whom, or share what with whom in multi-step story problems, who answers, who is asked to answer, whether science enters their minds as a winged and massive animal too foreign, too dangerous to approach, or as a way of moving slower than dance, a reverence they could learn to master. How often compliments begin at clothing or hair or displays of teeth. I keep watch because they are girls. And because I remind myself when each round of donation solicitations flutters from a stack of homework, no one knows our dependence on welfare, student loans, modest grandparent wealth, which began its steady accrual and spread generation to generation the decade before the Civil War. My parental vigilance has a singular focus, which is one of the pleasures of whiteness. 5. Because Eunice doesn't have the mandate her husband has to write, she will record her life in the banks of microfiche, whirring and toggling down the ear canals of her children and grand and so forth. The nature of the medium requires the telling be episodic and repetitive, which Eunice will delight in. 6. For instance, Eunice is in her far west home. Two men she's never met demand entry. Alexander is in jail, and they want to search for counterfeit currency and dyes. There is a rumor, a kind of story zygote. They believe because the rumor has thickened by circulating, like cornstarch in a broth, a gnat engorging on the pinging screen of the mind with each pass of the ears. Also, they believe because it gives them power. Far west is the McRae's first Missouri town. Some Mormon neighbors, they're all Mormon neighbors, began two counties ago, were driven out until state lawmakers created the present county on less desirable land exclusively for them. How effortlessly, if one is attentive, any American story reveals itself to be also about the red body, though the McRae's resisted mightily all attempts to paint them red. Having no lock the men would force anyway, Eunice lets them in, lets them pick lustily through the few cupboards and drawers of a frontier house built by Alexander the year before, lets them find nothing, which will not do. When they want to rip up the floor and dig around, they do not ask, and she does not protest as they knock out the puncheons and scatter the logs. What else for one woman isolated within designated acreage, with two men sharpened by majority power thinking they need to shovel dirt into her house? I imagine her little nameless wants to nurse, rooting in her arms, at her neck as she hoists him to her shoulder, and John, her toddler and eldest, in a corner with his knees up, hiding his face. Whether Eunice was one of the Mormon women raped by Missouri's male citizenry, the record is silent. Violated to gratify the hellish desires of the mob and finally left to perish with their helpless offspring clinging around their necks is what Smith will later dictate and Alexander will write in an epistle spanning 26 pages. And Eunice, after one of her visits, perhaps will clamp the folded sheets against the skin of each foot, making herself shod with holy outrage that gently obscures faces. When the Missouri men stomping dirt from their boots are satisfied in the tradition of people who believe they are white, they don't feel a need to justify their search, turn to leave, except Eunice, with a baby and a pistol, is blocking the door, saying, "Gentlemen, you have had your fun. Now put all that dirt back in the hole you took it from, and put the floor down as it was, and clean the floor." Amazing the rhythm and address as Eunice told it to her grandson, who wrote it to a nephew, who wrote it in the history. "Gentlemen," she called them. The men put back the floor and cleaned the floor. It's hard to resist repeating out loud and with awe, as I've done here, after setting up the context so each listener circled round might be stirred. One wants to offer the story as a model, which is a durable heirloom, and one wants to take it out into the day's shoving and shrieks. Eunice repeated the tale, and her descendants repeated the tale, a courage talisman against the dark, but also a talisman against darkening. Eunice reclaimed home and sovereignty, which is to say, in the country she was standing in, while holding her pistol, she gathered from the air between her mouth and the eyes of two white men who yielded whiteness to herself. Hard not to grab such power when it's so near, when it's the only power for miles that counts. But a mother needs both hands. This is a story about the body, and it keeps going from there.
Thank you.
Hello. All right, I'm just going to dive into it. Poetry of Witness, despite its old age as a tradition in poetics, is a recent and often troublesome phrase. Troublesome in the sense of the intrinsic problematic of what it means to be a witness, which often is to be a bystander, a person present but removed from involvement in the act they later relay. The question for the speakers of Poetry of Witness is always whether they did enough, whether, that is, the act of witnessing will be sufficient in and of itself. It's a genre of poetry that forces its speakers to collapse the mythical bifurcation between the personal and the political. And though this helps to resolve one case of myopia, it still leaves these poem speakers with the potential for another. The myopia that neglects that thin zone between the attendance and the attendance that makes witnessing possible and complicity. As opposed to the personal or the political, this witnessing complicity is the social, and we are guilty of it every day. Our media are alive with its failures. David Thacker's poems are poems of witness, and they are alive with the questions of what it means to record failures, to preserve them, to write failures down without the myopic false dichotomy between seeing and complying. His poems examine how seeing, if only seeing, is complicity, and that the action of witnessing does not establish innocence, much less grounds for self-congratulations. Witnessing is, in David's poetry, not the gratified penitence of confession. It isn't the flashy self-lacerations of the martyr on his soapbox, and maybe most importantly, it isn't a distancing effort. His poems aren't a way of simultaneously assigning blame to others and freeing his speakers of their complicit guilt. Instead, they do what many of the original and most powerful poems of witness, many of which involve details of foreign wars, intend to. They report a particular grief they've seen, a suffering they never expected to see. And they admit that this expectation is a symptom of their own negligence. In David's hands, this makes them also poems of entreaty, and sometimes poems of prayer. They seek to help, and they are also asking for help. Help, in a country like ours, where the central concern seems always to be a hermetic and self-seeking kind of power, can sometimes, when used on us or when used by us, feel like the dirtiest four-letter word. But in poems of witness, help is meaning, purpose, and structure. It is, against power, sometimes all we have. In the same way that poems of witness sometimes exist as the only artifact of the suffering they've recorded. And when we are asked for help, when we are asked to give it, especially as readers, it forces us, in turn, to confront, or maybe to confront again, or maybe even to collapse two other false bifurcations. One between what is individual and what is collective. Another, when acknowledging that something is necessary, between what is easy and what is very, very difficult to do. David Thacker grew up in northern Utah and has taught writing and literature at the University of Idaho and the Port Townsend's Writers Conference. a recipient of the Frederick Manford Award from the Western Literature Association, a Pushcart nominee, and a finalist for the Berkshire Prize and the Levis Prize. His poems have appeared in Best New Poets 2015, Plowshares, Plume, Subtropics, The Colorado Review, and elsewhere. He's a fourth-year PhD candidate in poetry. Please help me welcome David to the stage.
That was the nicest introduction. Jamie, thank you. And thank you to Tom and Josh for hosting, and for you who stuck around. I really do. I appreciate the privileges to read for you. And we'll try to make it worth your while. I'm going to start with a poem. It's a long poem. It takes about 12 to 13 minutes to read. Stick with me. It'll be worth it. but I have to start with apologies because it has some Spanish in it, and I don't speak Spanish, but I've been practicing, and even sought out some coaching, and practiced some more, and so I'm going to do my best. So you know, La Migra is colloquial for immigration police, or ICE, and then there's a longer passage of Spanish, and I'll give you the English translation for those like me who don't speak Spanish. Which is, the translation is, I could let despair slowly rot my life and the lives of my children, or leave. A couple of other things you need to know. Mandorla is an almond-shaped halo. Scapuli is the plural of scapula, like the shoulder blade, right? What else? A fistulated cow is a cow that has a hole in its side so that you can, like, study it and see what it's digesting. It's really weird to see. And where I grew up in northern Utah, quaking aspen are colloquially called quakies. And quakies grow, as they grow, the lower branches drop off as they become, like, dead weight. And they leave behind what looks like an eye. So they're called eyes. Finally, a probie is a firefighter in a probationary period. I think that's what you need to know. The title of the poem is called In the Story of When the Undocumenteds in the Upstairs Apartment Called 911, I Can Talk. And that opening, that title runs into the opening line, so I'll read it again. In the story of when the undocumenteds in the upstairs apartment called 911, I can talk about the stairs tread, like rows of open mouths, fanged but harmless if one wore shoes outside, ascending to dinner or descending to dinner. About how in harvest months, those still moths sifted an early hour of lateral sun, and thus spattered the walk up to our mat with white vesica pisces, which means fish bladders, but also means mandorlas around paintings of Christ, a sermon on repeat, and means especially spaces of overlap in Venn diagrams, a list, blank, obscured soon, proposing any two must be somewhere the same. Ice cream and flan, guffaw and howl, family downstairs with three birth certificates and family upstairs with one out of three. I can talk about the wall that fronted both our apartments, the siding's gesture of wood texture. On one panel, a yellow swell where a painter stalled a bit more banana there, 5 inches behind which, according to code, if built to code, laundry hummed in identical halls, and farther, a step, rooms we paced in nightlight, paced, bouncing our arms, mumbling, when desperate, whisper-singing lullabies we despise like any abracadabra, and there, see it? In our embouchure's indignation mixed with tenderness, vesica pisces, while each family's infant arched or fluttered lashes, and fluttered lashes, and finally slept. A girl downstairs, a boy up, two citizens. Though dreaming, with infinite space shoving upward past his tumble, one might flap and grasp and wake to parents enduring, as is said, la migra. About the confluence of our furnace pipe and the pipe from our water heater in a closet rarely opened, thin rings at each joint, a single cobweb bulked with dust, the stainless dole and specked, not enough nature to dub them vertical rivers, but each tube supplied walls, like banks, directing a current of warm exhaust from our modest wants at summer's ebb, laundry and a few degrees of heat, up and out, if unimpeded, our vent with its tin man's cap and collar periscoping the roof, and the upstairs vent, a few shingles higher, the same. It's true, the weather could be petulant, and true the words on our mats said welcome. True the numbers on our doors were gouty old style, with peepholes below the eights. About these things, I can say without worry a great deal. But hear the sirens in the distance. The fire trucks blats through an intersection, police and ambulance as well. In this story, the neighbors must remain undocumented, as law ensures, and any trail withheld, as deserts withhold the mercies to cross them. One at 19, missionary visa in hand, discovered passing as any resident was safer than where he'd been. The other, well, to say a child, perhaps four, in a big rig trailer, cupping the knobs of her mother's ankle in the purring black, so she can hold among the swelter and sour of each checkpoint in her mind a freckle she knows is under her left palm, and how it bobbed beside her bed, a tiny circle making a circle in the dark, like a sparkler in the dark. To say such a child is illegal, does that make her a melon in a bin of melons, mere contraband? So a citizen might comfortably post of a similar crossing, lock them in and set them on the bombing range, a free target, and a fat message to the fence hoppers. One at four became contraband. The sirens are growing strange, or you are. Hear it? Long seconds and no Doppler break. And the feeling an unfathomable change is coming to where you stand. I left you on a sidewalk outside a yellow apartment with metal stairs, and there's grass, a pinched square of green, more soft, more lank, not yet mown this week, where my wife is sitting with her cheekbones on her knees, dizzy, eyes closed, talking, when she talks, in spurts. And near her, the back of a man pacing, uneasy. Was it a stupid risk? His phone was the phone that summoned so many uniforms. And any might wonder, is he, after all, something other than the concerned neighbor huffing air? I was driving to work, toggling between sports news and wind. I did not hear the alarm suddenly shouting from our baby's room with screams from the crib crowding the words. Yawning through town, swigging from Nalgene a few times, a bloodish note in the water from too much iron, not a long commute. Four stoplights, then the parking macadam. Not a long commute at all. I did not see my wife run the hall, slip her hands under fluttering scapulae, and suppress her lift so our daughter's neck could tighten. Infinitesimal blue and fuchsia balloons lazily scattering in pairs on the washes and flows of a house is how I imagine. How else can one see carbon monoxide rising with updrafts and gyres to a nose, a mouth, as fish bladders without fish might drift an ocean into the same fragile caves and amass there? It is a coincidence, the harsh and precise voice declared in a British accent. Warning, carbon monoxide detected is one way in English to translate "Podría dejar que la desesperación lentamente pudra mi vida y la de mis niños o partir." Poison prevents my return is another. But what I want is your brain to simulate this crack in faux leather, like a brittle kiss above my wedding band while I turn the steering wheel. I want the hollow door my wife is beating upstairs for help now, the only thing your mind can hold. The latch rattling in its jam, the knocker's flinch. Until the door opens, you won't be shown a face that's contraband on a blur. Her thinking plane in her reach to take our child, who pixelates against her chin. And another blur dials dispatch and hands over his phone. My wife recounts, again recounts, tamping panic. In the square footage below, carbon monoxide billows toward their feet. I'm near my last light on the far side of our small city, again in awe of fistulated cows, and my wife and he descend the teeth that separate their lives, re-enter to raise windows. In the nursery, she pinches her breath against the sash, lifts through her back, her quads, her shins turn to sand, and her vision smooths. The ambulance, the cruisers, the fire truck haven't arrived as the noisy smears they'll appear to her, like this blur with sleeves and shoes, making her walk a hall, calling this bright path a kitchen. He steers and coaxes, half hoists, half pulls through a gap in panels of white. I want you to hear the ringtone filling up the sedan as I crunch to a stop under Lucky's shade. Ba-da-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. And to see the quakey out front scored with hearts. And midway up the trunk, a deep six tally carved in what would be the white of a large eye that radiates ripples from the cornea like a drop in a sippy cup or terror through a body. I admit I didn't see the tree then, but drove away, leaning into every turn. Months after, running late, that shock when scenery becomes an echo of memory, I swung into the same parking spot and saw the cops retake its place. The tally could mean paychecks or hookups or bouts won by knockout or submission, but an eye is a space that fills with likenesses. As one might see six scars within the eye-like tissue of a tree, echoing six neighbors in a reader's eye. What to do with your eyes? Those vesica pisces in your face. I could have you see how my body accelerated to please, which means it became a prayer. How officers, bored, leaned against the stairs while a masked probie with a sensor, trimmed red and chunky like a toddler phone, nonchalantly swept the interior, then startle shouted, 4400. We could imagine the ending where my wife can't remember her name, instead of an ambulance ride, a little oxygen. But let's linger with the neighbors while we can. We've been calm, and I forestalled. One's with the chief now. On the lawn, one sits with my wife, our kids tumbling on a blanket. Hear them tell me to call from the ER. Watch this woman who cradled my child for the EMT and now is stretching her child's arm until he grins and waves, "See you soon." And this man who might not be here long. Time to call you. about your representatives about DACA. Okay, I'm going to read just one more poem. Apparently, the longer that I'm in Tallahassee, the longer the poems get. So I've been working on a poem all summer that I'm calling a verse essay. And I'm going to try out just the first, what I think of as the first movement on you. So it's the first six sections. And I need to explain the title because it won't make sense because we won't get to the part of the poem that deals with the title. The title is Mormon Beef, A Case Study. And it's a Mormon Beef is a reference from my family history when some of my ancestors were in prison and some the jailers tried to feed them human flesh to paint them black. So that's what that refers to. Mormon Beef, A Case Study. One. Here is another story about the black body. In one episode, Eunice McCrae, my four-greats grandmother, baptized Mormon 18 months before, carries her infant across Missouri from far west to Liberty to visit the husband squatting in a low-ceilinged basement cell. Taking dictation through the winter will be his crucial action, and Eunice will make herself post office, postmistress, and carrier, tucking letters into her socks, her baby's homespun gown. The guards will search her only once, find nothing. The child, for now, is nameless. She's abandoned, moving their few belongings out of state to see her husband and to get her son a name. No part of her thinks she's black. No part of Alexander would entertain the notion his wife is black. Not the word between his shoulder blades when his need to stand his full height accumulates. Not the indignation ever ready to rise in her chest like a bear or the wrath of God in a spoiled blueberry patch. Two. I will tell how I enjoy some of the pleasures of whiteness. They are subtle and many. I want to be as precise as I can to know myself. In the theology governing like an old oak, the wilderness at the center of my life, to know oneself and one's species is what any child of God needs above all else, except to know God. And these knowings are not separable. What is the wilderness? A confluence of genetic lines, a thick undergrowth of stories. Three. The McCrae headstone now is all revision, a slant double of Georgia gray granite with roses etched by machine above their names, as if they died within the decade and not outside a century ago. You can see in the background of one photo the Salt Lake City cemeteries full of such stones, uniform and glossy in the mown grass, not a tilt or strewn bouquet among slabs that seem one more case of reaching for that respectability that claims to be an exceptional paragon of the common. I sit at a laptop with a North Florida avian chorus splash painting the morning, browsing photos and clippings, a family tree. I grew up 20 minutes north of Eunice and Alexander's bones and have never shuffled in the heat above them. The original markers, likely limestone defaced by desert snow, where have they gone? Granite respectability eluded the McCrays all their lives. But chiseled under Alexander in cup and caps, a descendant has paid to remind the morning walkers, grievers, and history buffs he was incarcerated, an expensive word, in Liberty Jail with Joseph Smith, their prophet. Three other men passed the Missouri winter with them under lock, including Hiram, Joseph's brother. A fourth left on bail. It was a time when a town in a slave state could be named Liberty without irony. In Mormon lore, the irony stops with the men in the jail and dubious charges. Below Eunice's name is silence. No caps in her story. Nothing about, for instance, fabrics. On the frontier, all was scrabble and handmade among the poor, and as she walked, it would have been her own skill and time, whatever she could hold back from looters, that kept or didn't keep the child and her body warm. She pulls up over the boy's head before setting out something soft as chaff. Every rough half mile, as any parent traveling slowly in the cold, she peeks through the fold slung at her heart. 4. When I drop my children off at school, and when I watch each teacher's face and track the vocal tones, the book suggestions, homework, and report card comments, the colors and depictions of the many stickers, what name sell what to whom, or share what with whom in multi-step story problems, who answers, who is asked to answer, whether science enters their minds as a winged and massive animal too foreign, too dangerous to approach, or as a way of moving slower than dance, a reverence they could learn to master, how often compliments begin at clothing or hair or displays of teeth. I keep watch because they are girls. And because I remind myself when each round of donation solicitations flutters from a stack of homework, no one knows our dependence on welfare, student loans, modest grandparent wealth, which began its steady accrual and spread generation to generation the decade before the Civil War. My parental vigilance has a singular focus, which is one of the pleasures of whiteness. 5. Because Eunice doesn't have the mandate her husband has to write, she will record her life in the banks of microfiche, whirring and toggling down the ear canals of her children and grand and so forth. The nature of the medium requires the telling be episodic and repetitive, which Eunice will delight in. 6. For instance, Eunice is in her far west home. Two men she's never met demand entry. Alexander is in jail, and they want to search for counterfeit currency and dyes. There is a rumor, a kind of story zygote. They believe because the rumor has thickened by circulating, like cornstarch in a broth, a gnat engorging on the pinging screen of the mind with each pass of the ears. Also, they believe because it gives them power. Far west is the McRae's first Missouri town. Some Mormon neighbors, they're all Mormon neighbors, began two counties ago, were driven out until state lawmakers created the present county on less desirable land exclusively for them. How effortlessly, if one is attentive, any American story reveals itself to be also about the red body, though the McRae's resisted mightily all attempts to paint them red. Having no lock the men would force anyway, Eunice lets them in, lets them pick lustily through the few cupboards and drawers of a frontier house built by Alexander the year before, lets them find nothing, which will not do. When they want to rip up the floor and dig around, they do not ask, and she does not protest as they knock out the puncheons and scatter the logs. What else for one woman isolated within designated acreage, with two men sharpened by majority power thinking they need to shovel dirt into her house? I imagine her little nameless wants to nurse, rooting in her arms, at her neck as she hoists him to her shoulder, and John, her toddler and eldest, in a corner with his knees up, hiding his face. Whether Eunice was one of the Mormon women raped by Missouri's male citizenry, the record is silent. Violated to gratify the hellish desires of the mob and finally left to perish with their helpless offspring clinging around their necks is what Smith will later dictate and Alexander will write in an epistle spanning 26 pages. And Eunice, after one of her visits, perhaps will clamp the folded sheets against the skin of each foot, making herself shod with holy outrage that gently obscures faces. When the Missouri men stomping dirt from their boots are satisfied in the tradition of people who believe they are white, they don't feel a need to justify their search, turn to leave, except Eunice, with a baby and a pistol, is blocking the door. saying, "Gentlemen, you have had your fun. Now put all that dirt back in the hole you took it from, and put the floor down as it was, and clean the floor." Amazing the rhythm and address as Eunice told it to her grandson, who wrote it to a nephew, who wrote it in the history. "Gentlemen," she called them. The men put back the floor and cleaned the floor. It's hard to resist repeating out loud and with awe, as I've done here, after setting up the context so each listener circled round might be stirred. One wants to offer the story as a model, which is a durable heirloom, and one wants to take it out into the day's shoving and shrieks. Eunice repeated the tale, and her descendants repeated the tale, a courage talisman against the dark, but also a talisman against darkening. Eunice reclaimed home and sovereignty, which is to say, in the country she was standing in, while holding her pistol, she gathered from the air between her mouth and the eyes of two white men who yielded whiteness to herself. Hard not to grab such power when it's so near, when it's the only power for miles that counts. But a mother needs both hands. This is a story about the body, and it keeps going from there.
Thank you.